You are listening to the 100th episode of Screenfish Radio. I'm your host, Steve Norton. In a wild left turn for the DC film universe, director Todd Phillips' latest film, Joker, takes us back to Gotham City in order to witness the birth of the Clown Prince of Crime. When we first meet the titular villain, his name is Arthur Fleck, a failed comedian who has been isolated, bullied, and disregarded by society. As things begin to unravel in his life and his mind, Fleck begins a slow descent into madness as he transforms into the iconic DC villain known as the Joker. In a very special episode, members of our Screenfish team tell us what the site means to them, we announce a very special giveaway, and Paul and Julie Levac stop by to talk about the dangers and brilliance of Todd Phillips' foray into criminal madness. Welcome back to the conversation. Welcome to Screenfish. Welcome to Screenfish Radio. We're thrilled that you can join us here this week as we talk about Joker, the comic book film that is not a comic book film, looking at the origins of the famed DC villain. I am so excited this week to have back our team of Levax, Paul and Julie. Welcome back, guys.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited to chat about this one.
Yeah, great to be here.
Certainly, I'm really excited to talk about the film with you both. It has been wildly divisive. But before we do that, a bit of housekeeping for us to take care of. First of all, I'm excited to say that this is our 100th episode of Screenfish Radio. I remember our first episode so well, in early May of 2015, when Arnaldo and I spoke about Age of Ultron. The format, the style has gone under tremendous changes over the last 4.5 years, but it has been such a wild ride through these 100 episodes, and there are so many people that we would like to thank. Starting with our team, and we have a great team here at Screenfish. I'd like to give them a little bit of time so that they can tell you what working on the website has meant to them.
Hi, this is Heather Johnson, and Screenfish has provided me with an opportunity to explore the deeper meanings within film and also to be a part of a great community that is supportive and encouraging.
What Screenfish means to me, Chris Utley. How do I even begin to encapsulate all that? Oh, I know. I'll just do it my way. Supposed to be a Christian site, but being part of this gives me the freedom to be my authentic, off-putting, off-kilter, irreverent self, and to just be blunt and total honest about the way that I view cinema, how it relates to our lives in Christ, and basically I just get to be myself as part of this team. You guys don't know the level of debating and seemingly arguing and all the back and forth that we have about so many different things, not just about cinema, but pop culture as a whole, except for TV, because I notoriously don't watch episodic television or Netflix. That's all I have to say about that. But this is a platform where I get to be the me that God has created me to be. And I am challenged by my fellow staff members. And again, I just get the freedom to be who I am and to express the way that I think in the unique way that God has equipped and put me together. And I love that. And I love the fact that I have a team who embraces me in that. They know how to rib and make fun of me. They know how to check me when I need to be checked. But most of all, they've embraced me into their brotherhood with open arms. I've developed great friendships as being part of this team. I've had wonderful debates as part of this team. I've had my perspective challenged. But like I said, most of all, I get to be the me that God created and Screenfish is the vehicle that I get to express that through. So congratulations, my fellow comrades in writing, podcasting, and cinematic and entertainment arms. Happy 100th podcast, Screenfish.
Hey, it's Julie Levac. To me, Screenfish has been an incredible learning experience. A lot of the films that I've reviewed have tackled really heavy and important topics like racism, mental health, sexuality, prisons, and the list goes on. The deeper that I dive into the films and the more research that I do about them, the more passionate I get about these topics. I have such a huge respect for the people who are putting these films out in the world and educating people. And I can't wait to continue learning through film and through Screenfish.
Screenfish matters to me because it's a way to meet culture head-on with the truths of Christ in a way people can relate to.
Hey, what's up, you guys? Welcome back to Teen... This isn't even a Teen Fish podcast. Gotcha. Anyways, my name is Daniel Collins, and I am the host of Teen Fish, and I absolutely love working with Screenfish. I really appreciate how Screenfish has opened my eyes to different genres of movies and shows, but if I take a second and think about it, my favorite part about working with them is that I'm constantly encouraged to ask myself different questions and just think deeper about what I'm watching so I can get the most out of it. I've really been able to look at shows and movies differently because of Screenfish, and I am truly, truly grateful for the opportunity and experience that I've got because of them. So thank you so much, Screenfish, and congrats on 100 episodes. Teenfish is slowly catching up, but we'll get there eventually.
I like Screenfish because it gives me an opportunity to view films, one of my passions, and then do lengthy film reviews with others who are equally crazy about movies. We view them from a faith perspective, but our talks are wide-ranging, trying to understand each film for what it is. And I believe that as everyone is created in the image of a creative God, that all types of movies show an aspect of humanity, God, or the cosmos that can enrich our understanding of who we are and what we are looking for.
I absolutely love working with this team. They are just so great. A special thank you to our team, Jacob, Alan, Arnaldo, Chris, Heather, Shelley, Daryl, Julie, Daniel, Jason Ty, and Jason Norton, and the countless others who have contributed not only to the podcast, to the website as well. All of you have worked so hard to help get us here, and I'm so grateful for everything that you've done. Also to the sites who have helped make this happen as supporters of ours, Real World Theology, Seeing and Believing, Feelin' Film, Cinemagogue. You guys have been with us since the beginning and supported what we're doing, and we are so thankful to all of you as well. And of course, most of all, actually, we would really like to thank you, the listener. Whether you've been listening to us from the beginning or whether or not this is your first episode, we are so grateful that you give us your time to hear what we have to say. It's so exciting to have been a part of this and to continue to be a part of this as well. This is our 100th episode. We are looking forward to the next 100 as well. So thank you to you all. And also, a very special contest, which we would like to announce here right now, is that we will be giving away, in honor of the 100th episode, a $100 gift card to get to the movies yourself. All you have to do to enter is to share this podcast on Instagram, on Twitter, and Facebook, wherever you can. And we would really appreciate it if you would rate and review us on iTunes. We will announce the winner on the next episode, which will air next Friday. So you have a little bit of time to get in on that. But we are very excited about this, and we cannot wait to get into the episode itself. So let's talk about Joker. The Joker tells the story of Arthur Fleck. Forever alone in a crowd, failed comedian Arthur Fleck seeks connection as he walks the streets of Gotham City. He wears two masks, the one that he paints for his day job as a clown, and the guise he projects in a futile attempt to feel like he's part of the world around him. Isolated, bullied, and disregarded by society, Fleck begins a slow descent into madness as he transforms into the criminal mastermind known as the Joker. Now, in an unusual trend for us, this week it is especially important to remind you that this podcast is rated S for spoilers, given that the film actually comes out today. So, Paul, Julie, what did you think of Joker?
I really enjoyed it. I had pretty high expectations going into it. If anybody has seen a trailer, you know that it looks epic and incredible. And there was a little bit of talk about it initially, how people were saying it was sort of an Oscar movie with the name Joker slapped on top of it. Do you know what I mean? And yeah, that's kind of what it is. It is an incredible film, Oscar worthy in my book. But I think that it did, bearing in mind I'm not a big comic book person, I don't really know the origin stories from comic books. In fact, I don't think that there really was one. But I think that they were able to incorporate an incredible film with the comic books, with an origin story, paying tribute to the previous Batman films. I thought it was kind of the whole package.
Yeah, I mean, and this might be taking more of the thunder away from it later in the conversation, but I'm not even convinced yet this was even a comic book movie. I enjoyed it. And it was really good for what it was. This was a more gritty, realistic take on your traditional comic book films. And for what it is, it's really good. And I appreciated the different take. I'm just not convinced it's a full-fledged comic book movie, or it's a completely new genre of comic book movie that hasn't been attempted yet.
Yeah, okay, I'll give you that. I won't say that it is not a comic book film. When people talk about comic book films, it's sort of its own... Well, I mean, it really is its own genre, but people get a certain idea of what they are. To me, a comic book film is really using comic book source material. And there's enough evidence of that in this one for me to call it that, but I agree with you, there's a totally different style of comic book film that we haven't really explored. I heard a comment years ago saying that nowadays, if a serious director wants to get a point across, what he has to do is slap tights on it and make it into some sort of superhero. And there's something to be said for that. But, I mean, I thought this film was brilliant. I really, really did. I thought there was so much originality and vitality in the film. There was a lot of energy in the film. Todd Phillips described it as a slow burn. I didn't think it was that slow. I found it as something that sort of kept its pace going quite well. And I agree. I thought the performances were incredible. And I thought the script was solid. And it allowed it, they gave it the chance to be what it wants to be without trying to put it too much into any sort of mold that it felt like a Batman film, because of course there is no Batman in this film, and I want to talk about that later as well. But I agree. I think that there was enough comic book in it that I feel comfortable calling it that, but it is not like anything you've seen before.
Yeah, I think I got a little bit concerned when the director said that it was a slow burn. But no, I thought it was paced really well. I didn't find myself feeling like this is taking forever, like let's get on with it. I was enjoying it from start to finish. And I feel like in terms of the more comic book aspect of it, that sort of happens more in the second half of the film. The first half, there's really nothing, in my opinion. But then when they start talking about... Wayne and I'm trying to recall, basically when they start talking about Wayne going forward,
Thomas Wayne,
yeah, sorry, that's when it sort of brings in the Batman sort of storyline, and it sort of takes off in that direction.
Yeah, I agree. That's why I say there was enough flavor to it. It was like getting a really great meal and then just sort of spicing it with a little bit of that, enough of that comic book elements that it felt familiar. You know, when Thomas Wayne shows up or they're going to the Narrows or something, as a Batman fan, I'm like, oh, okay, I know where this is. But it wasn't restricted by it.
Yeah, to a certain extent. I kind of felt going into it that there's only really one way to end this movie. Mm-hmm. And I felt like the murders of Thomas and I can't remember his wife's name felt like that was going to happen in the movie regardless of where the story went.
It's Martha. How could you forget that it's Martha?
Because in the Batman mythos, she's dead right away.
But it's the same mom as Superman. Anyway, that's a whole other movie.
Hey now.
I'm a big Dark Knight fan, so I appreciated, in my opinion, the sort of shout out to Dark Knight. So how we got to see when they were coming out of the theater before they went in the back alley and were murdered, which I think that was actually shown in the Dark Knight. My biggest Dark Knight sort of shout out in this one was when he was driving the car closer to the end and he was sticking his head out the window.
Yeah.
Totally reminiscent of Heath Ledger's Joker, you know, riding the back of the cop car, sticking his head out the window. I don't think I think that somebody mentioned that to the director and he said that it wasn't intentional, but I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I love that.
I mean, it was almost copied shot for shot. I don't see how that was intentional. Like, I don't care who you are. Someone's got to mention that in post.
Yeah, it was
pretty similar, let's be honest. And it just the vibe that I got from it just got me excited.
You know, we keep talking about this and comparing it to The Dark Knight, and I think that's a fair comparison.
But you can't.
No, yeah. Well, they're totally different films. But the reason that I thought Dark Knight was so powerful was I felt like if you had taken the Joker and taken Batman out of that film and put in like a dirty cop and a criminal mastermind that wasn't dressed as a clown, the film still works. And that's what I liked about this film, is that I felt that it still works. It didn't have to be the Joker for the film to work. Like, it wasn't dependent on that world, to me.
That's true. I feel like in general, I'm always going to sort of compare it to The Dark Knight because I feel like Heath Ledger's Joker was so iconic.
Yeah.
And so who was the Joker that was most recently played before Joaquin Phoenix? Remind me.
Jared Leto.
We don't talk about him.
Jared Leto. I love
Jared Leto. Were you saying we don't talk about Jared Leto?
Yeah, that's what I said.
I know that you're not a big fan of that movie. But Suicide Squad, that is.
Yeah.
For those wondering. like I said, Heath Ledger's Joker was so iconic that anytime a Joker is played, I personally kind of am going to compare it. I think that there are slight similarities between Heath Ledger's Joker and Joaquin Phoenix's Joker in that they were much darker, much more almost like mental health focused. Obviously, in this particular movie, it was largely mental health focused. But yeah, I thought they were both incredible.
See, I'm almost the opposite, though. Like, I didn't see any of Heath Ledger's Joker in this. I find Heath Ledger's Joker, while he's got seriously something going on mentally, it's more of a criminal mastermind teaching a lesson Joker. This is more of your like psychotic kind of the Killing Joke version, I would say, of the Joker, who's just there to cause more chaos than anything.
Yeah, it was just told in very different times in his life, right?
Yeah, I think that's the key.
They're so different, I guess.
I think that's the key, Jules. I really do, because I think that this Joker could easily lead into the Joker you see in The Dark Knight. But they're very, very different. By the time you get to The Dark Knight, he's an agent of chaos and a true, like, I just want to watch the world burn. He sort of falls into supervillainhood in this film, I felt.
See, I don't even necessarily see that. Mm. I see him as him starting the fire in the city. Basically the fire, quote unquote, social fire or whatever, right? But I don't see him doing much more after this because I don't think he has the mental capacity to do that.
But that's why he has all of his little minions. I mean, all of the other people in the clown masks that do his dirty work for him. We saw that in Dark Knight. We see it starting to blossom like that in Joker. It's that last scene where he's standing on the car. He throws his hands up in the air and he's their god. You know what I mean?
Is he a hero in this film? Is Joker a hero? Because he very much, you know, at the end of the film, is the leader of a revolution, which you could debate all that you want. Well, I don't think he intended for that to happen necessarily, but he's certainly reveling it at the end. So is he a hero?
To the audience, I would say this flat answer is no. To the inhabitants of Gotham at the time, there's a subset I would say he could be, but more from a symbol perspective rather than an actual hero that would do something, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I find this one kind of hard to answer because of the recent controversy with the film, which we will touch on a little bit later. But like Paul said, I think for the citizens of Gotham in that time, he is sort of a breath of fresh air or revolutionary of sorts, because we see there's some serious urban decay in Gotham. There's a clear lack of resources. Nobody's happy. You know what I mean? Everybody's struggling, it would seem. And I think that he was the first one to actually stand up and say, no, this is ridiculous. I'm not putting up with this, and things need to change. Although that's what it seems like to them, obviously, to Joker. Let me get his actual name in the film, because I don't remember.
Arthur Fleck.
Arthur Fleck.
That's the one, Arthur Fleck. To Arthur Fleck, he's just trying to get by, and you know, he ends up murdering people, and for some reason, to the citizens of Gotham, they find this to be sort of like a statement, a huge statement.
Well, that's the interesting thing to me about so much of this. You know, a lot's been made about him murdering business types on the subway. I mean, yeah, that happens. That happens for sure. But he sort of falls into it. Like, he does do it in a moment of, what have I done? They push and push and push, and then he snaps. But I don't think he's trying to make a point. I would make an argument that by the end he's trying to make a point, because that's exactly what he's doing on the TV series, right? When he goes on, you know, I was going to call it Leno, but it, you know, whatever it is. The,
Murray, oh no.
Yeah, Murray Franklin yes. Show. When he goes on Murray Franklin, like, it is absolutely about pageantry, and he's saying, call me by my name, you called me a real joker, so that's who I am now. You know, mm-hmm. he's bought into it. And I think it's an interesting way to view him as a revolutionary, mm-hmm. and if I remember correctly, Todd Phillips said in an interview about it, that he wanted you to be able to root for him until you couldn't anymore. Because here he commits this act of violence, and eventually he sort of makes that his way of life, you know? But at first, it almost seems like a strike back against the people that are holding not only him down, but everybody in the Narrows and in Gotham. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, in some ways, he feels like a hero to them. I agree with that. But I mean, as an audience member, you go, there's sort of a red light, or there should be a red light going off saying, hold on.
Well, I think, and I appreciated how much that Phillips was able to toy with the viewer's perspective throughout this film, in the sense that how he viewed the Joker, Arthur, because somehow you got situations where you're seeing visions that didn't actually happen.
Yes.
And so you're feeling something different for the character, but then when you find out it didn't happen, it changes from, you know, humor to almost pity at that point, right? And that the comment you made about rooting for him until you couldn't anymore, I think was really well done in this perspective, just playing with that perspective throughout it.
Yeah, I feel like they totally toy with your emotions in that way, because they make you think, or maybe he was at the time, this very caring individual. He's trying to do his best. He's struggling with mental health, but he's working and he's taking care of his elderly mother. Very caring. You know, we see him giving her a sponge bath and all that kind of stuff. He has this relationship with his next door neighbor. So he is sort of this caring individual. We come to find out that that relationship didn't happen. It was sort of all in his head. So I think that they do sort of treat the audience, either they were intentionally trying to trick us, or they treated us a little smarter, and they didn't want it to be sort of that conventional ABCD, you know, beginning, middle of an end sort of story. But yeah, it was very interesting how they played him initially, and how you do sympathize with him initially. And he gets beat up multiple times. He's being assaulted. He was trying to stick up for somebody on the subway. And it was, like you said, Steve, where he was just pushed so far that he snapped. And that sort of comes to one of my other points, which was the city, this urban decay in the city and the lack of resources for mental health, and this is sort of a whole other massive argument that we might not even need to get into, but, you know, he was having these therapy sessions and then they were cut off. I don't think that he was getting the help that he needed. And so that's another reason, in my opinion, why he sort of went down the path that he did.
So who's to blame then? Who creates the Joker? Like what, you know, that's a really interesting point. You say that, Jules. So where did he come from?
I think it's a mixture of a lot of the things that I said, which is, you know, he does struggle with mental health. I think it's a mixture of the lack of resources for people that struggle with mental health issues like he did. And I think that it is traumatic experiences in his life with finding out who his father was and then finding out that that might not have been his father and going through that whole trauma. So unfortunately, and then again, being assaulted multiple times is just one thing after another that he went through. And I think that because he didn't have the help that he needed, he didn't know how to mentally deal with his feelings.
I think it kind of boils down to empathy and a lack of it, to be honest. The message I got from this is just like, you need more empathy when dealing with individuals that have these issues. And just empathy in general. I found the world that they constructed was very uncaring and unapologetic for being uncaring. I think that lack of empathy drove Mr. Fleck to this eventual conclusion.
Yeah, you know what? I think that's a really interesting point. And you know who one of the key characters in this film for me was? Thomas Wayne. I loved how they presented Thomas Wayne because I've never seen him that way before.
Yeah, he's always been the beneficiary, the very nice, rich man.
You know what? And they didn't really even change that. It was all the perspective. Like, he didn't – the only thing he does where you go, wow, what a jerk, is the scene in the bathroom when he's trying to tell him who he is and he tells him to F off or something like that. You know, like, they have an altercation. But, I mean, whenever you see Thomas Wayne in the interviews in that, he hasn't said anything particularly, you know, inappropriate – they don't portray him, you know, Trumpian, where he's got mistresses or anything like that. They still hold him up as sort of a bastion of good, but based entirely on the perspective, he seems so uncaring. You know, he seems out of touch. You know, he's, oh, I'm going to clean up this town, stuff like that. You know, he almost feels like the sheriff in a Western. Like you said, Paul, no empathy in that he doesn't know any of the people. Like, face to face, he doesn't know anybody. You know, it's interesting how different Wayne Manor looks when you're on the outside of the wall. You know, all of a sudden it's something you can't get into. And even though he's saying all the things that he might have said in any other Batman film or comic book, the perspective isn't from him. And that totally changes it. You know, when you see the perspective of the people that are suffering, it does feel like there's a loss of empathy. You know, it does feel like there's, you know, no one listening. As far as I know, if I remember correctly, Thomas Wayne isn't to blame for cutting off his social service program because he's not in the office. But it feels like he's responsible. You know, it feels like the wealthy are the problem. It was a fascinating way to look at Gotham as the problems coming from the top down as opposed to the bottom up. That actually, and you know, going back to him being sympathetic too, there was another scene that really caught my attention. It's the scene in the bus with the kid.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, because it's funny because that could have played out, they could have demonized him right away. Because he laughs and the kid and what does she do? She says, "Don't you weirdo, get away from my kid, whatever it is, you know, don't talk to my kid." And he holds up the little card that says, you know, have empathy for me, basically. I can't control this. This isn't my fault. But if they hadn't shown that, he would have just seemed like a sociopath who's like a creep. But he's less creepy because they make him sort of a product of being broken, I guess. I don't know if that makes sense, but
yeah, I really appreciated the addition of the card that he would hand to people, and I think that you were saying this after we saw it, Steve, where making his laugh into a symptom of the disorder that he has, and the fact that he just breaks into laughter uncontrollably at random times. And then he hands out this card saying, you know, I'm sorry, I have a disorder, be patient sort of thing, or have empathy for me. I can't exactly remember what it said. And then even it was so almost painful to watch. And this really speaks to Joaquin Phoenix's excellent job portraying Joker, where he's laughing uncontrollably, but he's almost starting to cry through it. And his face is just so pained, but he's laughing. It's because, you know, he can't control this and he doesn't want to do it. And wow, it was just so powerful.
Well, and further to that, you can make an allusions to, the Joker in the comic books that would leave his calling card, so to speak, the actual Joker from a deck of cards. Mm. And this is just a completely different take on it.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to look. I thought it was a fascinating way to make him feel real, while at the same time preserving that sort of otherworldly element to him. With that in mind, much has been made of this movie before it even comes out by people. We hear about theaters beefing up security, and what I've seen articles say, this is the last movie we need right now from a culture that feels like it's bleeding. I would love to hear what you two have to say about that, because is the film dangerous? And if not, why not? And if so, why?
I sort of struggle with this one, because I can understand how people, especially the people who have experienced sort of some of this violence in real life, or people were speaking out about the shooting that happened in the theater when The Dark Knight came out all those years ago. Obviously, people who were directly affected by that would be concerned about this film, and I can completely sympathize with that. Obviously, I'm ignorant, so I saw the film, I loved the film, and that was it for me. But I think that it can have an issue. I think that people can have an issue with it, and I understand it. But in the same token, I think that it also can be a good way to speak on mental health and the fact that people are products of their environment, and if they don't have proper resources, then it is very detrimental to somebody. So I can really see it from both sides of the coins, and they're kind of really extreme sides of the coins as well. So I hate being so wishy-washy on such a serious topic, but it's really, I kind of struggle with the answer.
I don't think I don't think it's dangerous at all. It's an action. It's art. It's a film. I'd struggle to call it dangerous personally.
Now, why is that, Paul?
I think a lot of the time it's hitting culturally on, you know, right on the head for a lot of stuff that's going on in popular culture that we're talking about right now. You know, mental illness, violence in society. I don't think that makes a film dangerous. I think it makes it film valuable to a certain extent, because it's actually spurring the conversation and starting those conversations that we desperately need to have as a society.
I personally can separate and sort of understand the value in a piece of art, even though it's, you know, not something that, how do I describe it? You know, something that might be extreme. I can see and appreciate the art, but I'm just saying that I can understand why somebody who's been through something as serious as some of the people that are speaking out against it, why they would take issue with it.
But, like, in the same token, do we stop making movies about World War II because it was difficult?
Very, very valid.
Right? Do we stop making movies about other difficult topics because they're hard? No, I think we keep making them because they're hard to have those discussions and talk through them properly.
I think if this was a Scorsese movie, well, it is a Scorsese movie. He produced it, as my understanding. I think he was one of the producers. But if it wasn't packaged in a comic book form, it would be one of those violent movies that just happens. It's funny because we don't have these conversations in the same way about, like, John Wick. And John Wick is infinitely more violent than this movie, and I cheer the more people John Wick kills. This movie, I'm horrified every time he pulls the trigger.
I'd argue that to a certain extent, because John Wick is comic booky in its violent nature. This is very realistic, very, very, very gritty. Like, I think of the scene in his apartment.
Yeah,
like, that's true. That was very well shot, but pretty much exactly what would happen that way.
Yeah, it was definitely a brutal scene. I think that was the first. Sorry, not the first killing, but like the first where he was intentionally like, no, you have to die. It was definitely deep. It was definitely raw and a little bit disturbing. So yeah, I was just going to say, like, why Joker? Why specifically this movie in comparison to, like Steve said, things like John Wick or other movies where they're just, people are dying left, right, and center. So yeah, maybe it's because this one is a little bit darker, a little bit more realistic and disturbing.
I think it comes down to the packaging, because Joker feels like, you know, Joker can be anything from Heath Ledger in The Dark Knight to Cesar Romero in the 1966 Batman films, right? So there's something.
Hey man, Cesar was amazing.
There's something that makes it a little more easily accessible, I think, about that. But I also think that that's what makes it so much more compelling to discuss. Like, there's a safer distance between you and the subject matter if you can separate it a little bit by putting it in the fantasy of world of Gotham, even though Gotham is New York. Again, I think it's interesting. The three of us are Canadian. We saw it in the Toronto Film Festival, and it premiered at Venice, where it won. And ultimately, it's really a dark look at American culture. And so I understand why, you know, from an American's perspective, it might have a different view and tone.
Yeah.
But to me, I thought it was actually a film that really points to what happens when the world loses touch with itself and its people, loses touch with the faces of the people that it's affecting, and the decisions that are made that actually create systems that set up that violence. Like, his mother the entire time is waiting for Thomas Wayne to show up with the magic money and the medicine to make all their problems go away. That she is sitting by the phone, literally, waiting for something to happen, because don't worry, something good will happen. But the world has passed them by. It's completely out of touch. And so mental health resources are drying up. Poverty is running rampant, and there are no clean answers. All we're getting from the incumbent is, I'm going to clean this place up. Well, you don't know the problems.
Well, considering halfway through the movie, he literally just gets dumped from his mental health support. It's like, nah, we can't support you anymore. We're closing.
Yeah, for sure.
I think one of the lines that really drove home to me and like talking about the mental illness part, and it wasn't even a line he spoke. It was when he wrote in his notebook later on. And I had to double check the actual phrasing of this one. But it's the worst part about having a mental illness is that people expect you to behave as if you don't. And yeah, that just really hit home and felt very at home in this movie and in this Gotham.
Yeah.
I love that.
And it's interesting that he uses the TV. It's kind of funny because, I mean, the film, there's no such thing as YouTube, but they use it almost like a YouTube sensation. He goes viral, right? But who is his idol? Is a TV star, because they look like they have it all together. You know, people like seeing him. He can, I think at one point, doesn't he have a fantasy where he hugs him like his father and he says, I didn't have a son like you or something like that, isn't there?
That's right.
Yeah. You know, like this is how disassociated he becomes. And he's just clamoring for healthy relationships and there just are none. Like anywhere in his life. Even his mother is codependent. To me, the film's importance lies in how terrifying it is. You know what the scariest moment in the film is for me? Is the moment that I loved him the most. And it was him dancing on the stairwell, and they're playing History of Rock and Roll Part 2, Gary Glitter. And it's like the most fun in the whole movie. And then it ends so abruptly, and you realize, oh, wait, he's killed people. but it's like this moment of freedom for him. That's a scary moment.
But the freedom there is almost because he's finally figured out what he is.
Yeah.
He has an identity now.
But see, that's the scariest part to me. Because that's the part you celebrate is, he's become the Joker, which you're waiting for the whole movie. And now this is the Joker we've been waiting for. Oh, wait, he smashed a guy's head into his wall and shot three people in the subway. Oh, right, I forgot about that part.
Yeah, that's interesting that you were talking about freedom and how he's finally sort of being who, I don't know, I say this loosely, but sort of becoming who he was meant to be or whatever you want to say. But I found a lot of symbolism in the that massive staircase that he has to walk up every single day. You know, it gives you that sort of stereotypical uphill battle, how everything is difficult for him. But then when he puts on his final Joker costume and makeup, when he's going to the Murray show and he is leisurely dancing down the stairs, it's almost like something is free in him and that this weight is off of his chest. I thought that was really interesting, and I think that is actually the scene on at least some of the movie posters, that scene of him like dancing down the stairs.
Well, it's in all the trailers, and it's easy to see why, because that's the Joker everybody's tuning in to see. You know, mm-hmm. People want to go, which is interesting to me because, I mean, we've seen Batman movies without the Joker. We've never seen a Joker movie without the Batman. And
well, hold on. Technically, Batman was in it. Mm. Technically.
He's like 10, dude.
Well, he's still Batman.
That was interesting, though, that meeting between the two of them, especially when I was gullibly like, oh, wow, they're brothers, and they don't even, like, all this time, Batman and Joker have been
Batman
brother.
And Robin?
What? I was going to say Robin, ignore me.
Yeah, I love that little twist. But you see, that was the thing I liked about the film, too, is that it kept giving you things and then taking them away. Hey, they're brothers. No, they're probably not. Hey, he's in love with the girl next door. Yeah, that didn't happen. And even at the end, there's sort of this wink when he's staring at the camera. It's almost like, did any of this, or is it all in his head? And I thought that was really interesting way to... It actually kind of preserves the whole mystery of the Joker as well, in some ways. But
well, and they kind of eased you into that thought process, too, with his work situation, right? Like, oh, he's well-liked at work. Nah, not at all.
Yeah. Yeah, everything in his life is an illusion. Okay, so let me ask you guys this then. Just thinking about this, I mean, you just brought up Batman. Sure, he's in the movie, but do you think the film ends on any semblance of hope, or is it just that we're stuck in the cesspool?
No, I don't think there's any hope. That sounds so weird saying that. Yeah, I don't think that there's hope. I think that it just gets worse. Unless you are one of the sort of revolutionaries who are like, okay, great, we've got a leader. Let's get out there and make things better for ourselves. So I guess it just depends on your perspective.
Yeah, see, I kind of wondered if, you know, you talked about how they had to have the death of Thomas and Martha Wayne in there. I think they put that in there just as much, even though they said they did it because they thought it would be cool. I really felt like they did that as well to give you something to hope towards. This movie ends and the city's in utter chaos. But to me, the most hopeful thing is that Thomas and Martha Wayne are shot because we know what's coming. You know, the city's just left burning, literally on fire. And
As you said, that's almost a decade. That's a decade and plus away, though.
I know, but at least there's some sign that something can happen that's good. That's how I felt.
But there needs to be so much havoc that comes next.
Yeah.
That births Batman.
But isn't that really the key defining moment that births Batman, is the death of his parents?
True.
I mean, there's lots of other things that have to happen, don't get me wrong, but I was talking with Jacob about this earlier today, because he was asking me if he should go see the Joker, and I said that, well, you know, the truth is, this is what the film is, and I told him, but it reminded me, and I'm not trying to hyper-spiritualize it or by any stretch, but it reminded me of what Campolo used to say, Tony Campolo used to say. We used to say it's Friday, but Sunday's coming. This movie's so much Friday of just there. That's why I thought the death of Thomas and Martha Wayne was good, because to me it left a light, knowing that even though we're stuck in this cesspool and it's going to get worse before it gets better, at least we know it's going to get better because the events have been set in motion. But maybe that's overthinking it. But that's how I sort of felt about that. It was like, oh, phew, they're dead. Which is a weird way to think about it.
It's very strange.
The trauma is bad. I'm not saying it's bad, but I know that that's the moment that the seed is planted. Because the city's literally burning to the ground any other time, right? And you've got this guy who is conducting it like a symphony. And they keep going back to this idea of the chaos being sort of musical. You know, he sort of, every now and then, he acts like he's conducting. You see, it was really kind of a cool image.
Yeah.
But I don't know. That's sort of how I felt about it. Is there had to be something good to end it on it. Otherwise, there's nothing left. The world is going to die, everybody.
And I guess stay tuned for the next movie.
That's right. Oh, my gosh. What do you do for a sequel for this? You can't do a sequel for this without having Batman in it. It would just
that's
be him.
The thing. I think this one is a standalone. I mean, who knows? They could do it incredibly, but I feel like because they sort of connected it to the death of the Wayne parents, that what else do you do without including Batman when he's like a rebellious teenager? I mean, no, nobody cares.
Well, you could also do other origin stories and then bring it back together, a la Avengers Endgame. Right? You do other villains, and then eventually you bring it all together.
You got the DC origin universe now, because we need another one.
Yeah.
Penguin, who wants to know where he came from?
Oh, man, a Penguin movie. I'd tap out at that. Although I would handle a Riddler movie.
We already have a Harley Quinn movie coming.
That's true, yeah. I think
it's already in post, isn't it?
It's or February or March. It's early spring. But it will be disconnected to this film. If they had a Harley Quinn show up in this one, that would have been hilarious. Well, this seems like a good place for us to start to transition, guys. Let's screen it or skip it. Joker, screen it or skip it.
Let's put the controversy aside and just say that Joker is an incredible film. Cinematically, the acting is incredible. Joaquin Phoenix threw everything into this role. He embodied it, and it was fascinating. I'm not sure how the Academy is going to take it, but it is worthy, in my personal opinion, of an Oscar nomination for Best Film and Best Actor and Director. So let's see what happens around Oscar season. But definitely go see it. Definitely see it on the big screen. You have to. It's an action movie.
Yeah, definitely screen it. It's I'm torn on the Oscar stuff because it depends on how the Academy is going to lean. But honestly, it's if you're a film fan and have any minor interest in the storyline, you're going to enjoy yourself. Even if you have no interest in the storyline, it's great acting, well written, cinematography is great, and the world they constructed is gorgeous. It's a really great homage to 70s, 80s New York. They got everything right, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, they really did.
Fashion, cars, just the look and feel of the city around them, really well done.
Yeah, this is an absolute screen it for me. I thought his performance is brilliant, and he, not only does he deserve a nomination, I think he deserves to win. I don't think it stands a chance in Gotham's fiery blazes of winning Best Picture. I hope it gets a nomination, although it'll be interesting from the response. It's now down to 77% on Metacritic when it was like 90% when the early buzz started. So it'll be really, really interesting to see what happens with the audience response. I think it's a bit hypocritical for us to burn, no pun intended, burn this one down when so many other films are held up for Oscar glory that are ultra-violent. But I do think that this film is just really well executed on just about every level. And I think that it raises some fascinating and very important questions about our culture and about how we create villains. And I mean, obviously, I understand the severity of the controversy, and I mean, there are people that attach themselves to certain characters in certain moments, but I just don't think that a film like this creates the villains. I think it highlights villainy for how it shows up as opposed to encouraging it.
I think it is a really important conversation about mental health. And I, like I said, I can appreciate people taking issue, but at the end of the day, I think that it's fantastic, and it isn't as horrendous as people are making it out to be. And I think that it's actually been proven, and Paul, maybe you can help me out with this one, that in terms of the influence of film and TV and video games on people and encouraging people to, do these acts of violence, that it's actually been proven that these aren't really the causes. So I don't mean to be insensitive, but I don't think that this is the problem.
Yeah, there's several studies on those. I'm not going to get into the details on that, but there's a ton of studies that talk about violence in media and support what you're saying, Julie.
Yeah.
I absolutely hear what you're saying and can recognize the complexity of the issue 100%. I don't think that this necessarily helps the problem. I'm not going to say it helps violence in our culture, but I do think it points us to having a healthy conversation about issues of violence, mental health, and all sorts of things, that it can get a conversation started, which I think is more important. But no, not everybody's going to like it.
No.
I mean, for me, this is an absolute screen it for me. Guys, this was fun. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
Anytime. Thanks for having us.
Anytime. And for you at home, a reminder that you can find us anywhere you find your podcasts, on Stitcher, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Podomatic. And if you go to the podcast page at screenfish.net, you can download Fishing for More, which is small group questions that you can have with people that you see the film with, should you decide to do so. We will be back next week to talk about Judy, the Judy Garland biopic. And as always, and for the 100th time, we started the conversation. This was Screenfish.